Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Two Democrats have announced their intentions to run for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2020. U.S. Senate candidate Skylar Borglum has a plan to take on the national debt, and posters for the American Identity Movement mysteriously show up around the USD campus in Vermilion. That's on the Dakota Political Junkies shortlist for today's conversation. Joining us from the USD campus in Vermilion is Mike Card. He's Associate Professor of Political Science. Welcome back, Mike. Thanks for being here.
I'm very pleased to be here. It's a Chamber of Commerce day and a wonderful walk across campus.
Perfect. And on the phone, we have Jonathan Ellis. He's an investigative reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, good to have you back as well.
The skies are blue.
All right. And many times this year, as we talked about sort of miserable weather, it's nice to have one of these days. So, Jonathan, let's start with this the South Dakota Democratic Party and an audit, and the story is going to kind of unfold a little bit as we go. But before we do that, Jonathan, help us go back to the 2016 election and tell us there's some financial decisions that are problematic that are being looked at in an audit. What's going on here? How did this begin?
Well, it began, South Dakota's Democratic State Party was one of probably about three dozen or so that were used to sort of as pass-throughs between the Hillary Clinton campaign and then the national DNC in order to bypass, skirt campaign finance spending limits. And so South Dakota, of course, has been one of the states, the party's been one of the states audited on that. And I think they found roughly about $2.5 million that had been passed through the state party then to skirt these campaign finance rules. You know, it was interesting at the time, and I haven't looked at these reports in a while, but looking at them back in maybe a couple of years ago, that you saw kind of very odd kind of donations coming into the state party, and then you saw the state party then sending out money. But, I mean, you know, very odd donations from people in, you know, New York and California, and just play here thinking, why would these people be donating money to the state, you know, the South Dakota Democratic Party? So anyway, the Democrats, and I think that there are some allegations the Republicans will also use the same loophole, you know, found a loophole and were able to kind of bypass campaign finance spending limits. The audit has not been finalized because the FEC, which conducted the audit, doesn't currently necessarily have a quorum of commissioners who can vote to approve the final audit. So it remains kind of in limbo right now to see, you know, how that will ultimately shake out.
All right, so when you say the money has passed through, none of it landed in a Democratic candidate in South Dakota. You know, they weren't used in the state at all. It was just plain from one place to another. Is that what the indication is?
I can't say that definitively,
right.
Hence
the audit, right?
Yeah, the vast majority of it would have been used as a pass-through, correct.
So, Mike Card, tell us, is this, Jonathan used the word loophole, so is it legal, is it not legal, what's going on here?
Well, generally a loophole is viewed as something that's legal but fails the smell test in some senses. You know, you're able to donate to a larger organization that has multiple candidates signed up to be members, and you can distribute the money equally among them. That's legal.
And the smell test, Mike.
Well, I think the smell test is, well, boy, that's a lot of money. And it's not all, we don't like money coming in from out of state. I don't think any state likes money coming in from out of state to influence its elections. And that draws people's attention, and not in a positive light.
So, Mike, this notion of, you know, we have the Republican Party, Dan Lederman, saying, you know, we told you so. We knew this was sort of fishy from the beginning. We have Paula Hawks, who's in charge of the Democratic Party, saying, yeah, there was a lack of oversight. Let's talk a little bit about the response from local party leaders as, you know, the audit process stalls. How are people sort of, you know, spinning it in a way? Mike, let's start with you, and then we'll ask Jonathan the same question.
Well, that is an interesting question. The spin that I've seen is we didn't pay enough attention. You know, the nicer way to say that is there was a lack of oversight. Anything put in passive voice hides the actor. The the counter view is you weren't paying attention. And I think that's where we're at with the lack of reporting.
Yeah.
And often, you know, we haven't heard from the individual involved with the accounting, or I haven't seen it. Perhaps it's been in one of the other newspapers, but we haven't heard from the person who actually did the reporting, and I haven't been able to find the actual reports itself, but I haven't looked very hard.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts on really what needs to be said for, and how is it going to be used by the Republican Party in the state? Clearly nationwide, the Republicans are having the same problem, but not necessarily in South Dakota. And how are the Democrats kind of handling this whole thing as it unfolds in the state?
Well, I mean, certainly the current leader is trying to shift blame to the past leader. And the Republicans are saying, you know, I told you so. The Republicans have been talking about this actually for quite a while. I mean, they were looking at, again, all of these kind of weird campaign irregularities with money coming in from all sorts of weird places. And then, you know, so they've been, this is not new to them. And obviously this audit's been ongoing for a while. Of course, you know, you try to use it as political advantage. You try to paint the party as, you know, it's kind of unseemly and corrupt, and that's, you know, that's what you do in politics. You know, I think the broader takeaway is that campaign finance laws are really just, campaign money in politics is like water. It's going to go somewhere. It's going to find the place of least resistance. And so, I can remember when McCain-Feingold placed really severe limitations on what political parties could raise, and suddenly you had, so you changed the scope of campaigns. Suddenly the Democrats actually were very good at seizing on a new way to get money into politics through 527 groups. And so it's always this kind of escalation of where can you find the path of least resistance to get money into politics. I think these laws like McCain-Feingold and all of the laws, they're well-intentioned, I suppose, in terms of people trying to limit abuse of money in politics. But at the end of the day, they never really seem to be all that successful.
Hmm. So as Jonathan mentioned, the Federal Elections Commissioner, Matthew Peterson, is resigning, which means they don't have a quorum, which means this whole audit process is sort of in limbo, and it doesn't move forward. Jonathan, does that affect 2020 at all? Does it affect how donations are? I mean, can people still be using the state's parties as a pass-through?
Well, I'm sure, the legality of that, I don't know. We'll see. I think... certainly the Republicans are going to be quick to point that out if it looks like it's being done again. With the audit in limbo, I don't know what kind of penalties there might be, what might happen. So, yeah, I mean, is that method going to be used in 2020? I mean, I would doubt now that the light has been kind of shed on it, but, I'm sure people will be looking for it.
Yeah. Mike Card, is there any kind of value in... Do you anticipate them challenging each other to, to make a commitment not to do this, even though it's possibly a legal sort of action? Does it come into play in the conversation, or does it just kind of quietly go away as people say, we're not going to do that anymore, but we're not going to talk about it either?
Well, I think it depends upon what other issues there are to raise. In a sense, we've got a fight, and in a fight, almost no holds are barred, so to speak. And I would expect that if no issues seem to come up, we will hear more about this from the Republican Party. And if there are issues to bring up, we're going to see both parties blame each other. One would be from a national perspective, and the other one would be at a state perspective. But I think Jonathan's comment is most valuable here for us to remember, and that is the money will find the candidates. And there are very good lawyers and experienced lawyers in campaign and campaign finance who will find that loophole, that opening. We say a loophole, giving it a bad idea, but a loophole is simply an opening in the law that allows for, in this case, investment. And the key here is whose voice are we hearing?
Mm. Interesting. All right, so let's talk about some of those candidates looking to be a landing spot for some of that money, because we have some new faces in the races. And last week, I believe the conversation was in anticipation. We've got some announcements and more details. We've got some Democrats, Jonathan Ellis, who have decided to challenge U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson for the state's only seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. What do we know about these folks, an East River candidate and a West River candidate?
Yeah, one of them is, well, they both are share in common that they have run for office, legislature, and were not successful, but so they do have a little political experience. And Brian Worth is from Del Rapids. And then you've got Whitney Raver, who's from the West River. So, you know, that's a start. I mean, and they're both running for House. So presumably they would be a primary, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are additional candidates in that race. And so that's a start for the Democratic Party. You got to have candidates. Now, ideally, you would have sort of a bench of candidates who have already kind of had some success, whether, you know, in politics, but... And the Democratic Party is coming off a pretty miserable decade stretch here where what candidates they would have had on that bench just don't really exist. So they've got to start somewhere, and this is where you start. You know, there are – it's not, you know, it's not unheard of in an election where somebody maybe, you know, didn't have previous elected experience can win a race like this. I mean – you look at 1970, Jim Abrask was able to win the, back when we had two congressional seats, was able to win a Western District seat, and he had not held office before. I think you can say the same thing about George McGovern when he won. So it's not unheard of. I mean, I think the differences between Abrask, you know, for example, Abrask had been vigorously campaigning for the rural electric cooperatives against a Governor Frank Farrar bill that was highly unpopular. So Abrask did have sort of this statewide name by that time that the other candidates, at least at this point for these two Democratic candidates, don't maybe have right now. But again, it's a start. That's what you need to start with. You need candidates.
And that was something that the Democrats, Mike Card, made a big deal about last election, that they were able to field so many new candidates. We had many of them on this program for our Meet the Candidates section, along with the Republicans. And they were kind of jazzed up at the time that they had found so many people and were starting to build this pipeline of experience and, you know, communication. Do you see that happening with the Democrats here? Because other people, Mike, are just saying, you know, they're just throwing whoever out there and not necessarily a viable candidate. What do you make of that?
Well, the term I've heard is placeholder, is we need somebody to be on the ballot. And I think it was 2010 when no one ran against Senator Thune. I may be off a little bit there, but and that just is a giveaway election that allows the candidate to loan their money to other candidates for office. I think it's pretty early in the race. They're going to need to raise money. They're going to need to talk to voters. Again, as Jonathan noted, Jim Abrask was well known because of his law work and opposing a very unpopular policy put forward by then-Governor Frank Farrar. So he was well-known, and he name recognition is the game in politics. Mm. And it often takes money to do that, but if it isn't money, then it's exposure. And so I think they need to get out. There's a partisan disadvantage against a Democratic candidate, and the race will really turn on how many independents the Democrats can get to vote for them, or Republicans, because we really have a continuum here, those who are independent of any political party and the Republican Party, which is sort of split into two, if not three, factions, and the Democrats, who have the old and new and their own factions. We have lots of political parties, but only two labels, as well as the Libertarians, as well as the Constitutionalists and a number of other political parties. But for most of the electorate, they're either a registered Republican or a registered Democrat, or they're independent of any political party, so they can vote in the primary with Democrats.
So we should point out Whitney Raver of Custer has not technically announced yet. She's planning on it, but she's confirmed that she's running, but she hasn't done that formal announcement. Now, Skylar Borglum has done that formal announcement, and she's intending to run against Mike Rounds. She's a Republican, and now she's bringing some policy stuff forward. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about this focus on national debt is something she's kind of going after the Republicans now and saying we can do better as Republicans to reduce that. What's her plan, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, is this, circa 2014 where you have a Republican talking about the national debt? But, since winning the presidency, I think you recall in the 8 years of the Barack Obama presidency that Republicans frequently talked about deficits in the national debt, and then all of a sudden we don't hear about that very much anymore from the Republican Party. So here we have, I think, Skylar Borglum. I do think that there are a number of Republicans out there who are very concerned about the national debt, and so this is potentially an issue that could have some traction with voters. But she says that they need to start doing something about the $22 trillion debt. I think she's proposed, it's kind of interesting, she's proposed that if a budget were to exceed the 5% of the previous year's discretionary budget, that it would go to a national vote, which that's kind of an interesting take on representative democracy there. But, it's something certainly different, and it's certainly, I think a lot of conservatives in this state look at that national debt and really kind of get worried about that.
Yeah, and so this is the national debt is impacted by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but she's also has this plan to sort of say there's an innovative way to get around it, which is sort of triggering this national vote component. She wants to take a little of the power away from Congress. Mike, what do you think? Is that a good way to run for Congress? Is to make the promise? Who it kind of reminds me of is Tim Bjorkman, who when he was running was talking about the sort of drastic changes he would make to kind of dial back the dialing for dollars. Didn't get very far with that, although it was a really important to him, during the campaign.
Well, the dialing for dollars in the campaign finance is a different issue,
right, yes.
Related to our first part of the conversation, a populist perspective, and that is the idea that we should let the people vote on whether we're going to increase our debt in a given year or the amount of money that we're borrowing that's above and beyond the revenues coming in. That's just odd for certainly this. What we've seen coming out of the South Dakota legislature, if they're representative of the people's will. So it's an interesting idea to take money away from, take the power away from Congress to do that, and to do so with a national referendum. I suspect that would require a constitutional amendment, but I'm not a constitutional law scholar.
Well, we'll talk more about that in the future. And I want to make sure we get to what's happening. School has started. The students are back at college. We're talking with Mike Carr down in USD. And one of the first things that people are talking about is these posters from the American Identity Movement, which have showed up on the University of South Dakota campus. Tell us, Mike, a little bit about what you know about these posters appearing on campus and who they're from.
Well, they're from an organization called the American Identity Movement, and its initials are AIM. And I'm old enough to remember when AIM meant something very different in the state of South Dakota. And I thought, wow, the American Indian Movement is putting up, membership posters. Right. And then I started looking more closely at these and realized, no, this really isn't the American Indian Movement. I don't know if there was an intention in that or it was just the national branding of the organization to really focus on identity. And it appears that they are an organization. I haven't seen any students, and the students I talked with yesterday and this morning, none of them know anyone who put up a poster, which is really odd. They usually have a pretty good network. But there were posters, I think 8 in total that I saw, not in total, but 8 different posters in many of the bulletin boards. There aren't things up yet, so they were quite a bit of attention. There were so many posters around that they were lying in the floors and on wastebaskets and in chairs. Somebody put some real money into this. These are 8.5 by 11-inch posters that show largely workers, you know, protect American workers seems to be the message, as well as not being supportive of diversity. I don't know how better to say that, because, you know, diversity ends nations or something like that was one of the posters. Right.
Diversity destroys nations is the language that I'm seeing. Jonathan, this is this American Identity Movement is really a rebranding of another organization. They're looking to sort of refresh their marketing message to recruit college students. Tell us a little bit more about what they're after by a poster distribution at a university.
Well, from what the Volant was reporting, they are trying to recruit some college students. It's interesting because, you know, the diversity is kind of at the heart of our university system. I mean, it's very instilled, I think, in students and the importance of diversity and things like that. So they're kind of at the heart of where a lot of efforts at fostering diversity are found. I thought it was interesting too that the founder of this group told the Volant that this is, you know, they're a nonviolent group. They reject all political violence and racial supremacy, which I thought was interesting. So, we've had some in the wake of some very fairly violent acts by people who are white nationalists. So I thought that was kind of an interesting take on it. But yeah, they are trying to recruit students in what it would be sort of the heart of efforts to foster diversity in the United States in the university system.
This is a group that helped organize the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and some of their messages back and forth have been leaked. Talking about mass deportations and segregation and Holocaust denial. So this is part of a rebranding effort, as I said, Mike, to sort of make the organization a little more palatable to mainstream college students. I guess I don't know who exactly to get media coverage like the conversation that we're having right now, perhaps. Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think they also have posterized Augustana University in Sioux Falls, and it'll be interesting to see where else they go. Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of the social contract that, in essence, organizations like this are trying to put forward a message so that they can attract members. We don't always pay attention to all of the messages or the implications of the messages that people are sending, but, you know, it's about what rights do we have as individuals, and as social contract is what rights are we willing to give up to the government so that we can maintain other rights that are important to us. And in this case, it's, you know, should we have more open borders or diversity is specifically the case. It's interesting to me that this is just an idea that we have to have engagement of conversation that we hope is civil. We're governed by a board of regents who spend a lot of time examining whether our free speech rights on universities are discriminatory or whether we're allowing an open discussion of ideas. Hmm. And I know that some of the posters were taken down because in certain places at the university, you have to have the posters be date stamped, and that's so that we know when we can take things down rather than have someone come along and take down all posters so that they can put theirs up. Right. And that's usually in the university union area. But
you have to obey the poster policy.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain rules that apply to everybody no matter what your perspective is.
Right.
And in order to have free speech, we allow free speech.
All right. We'll leave it there. So Jonathan Ellis and Mike Card, thank you so much for being here with us today for the Dakota Political Junkies. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Lori.
You can find his work at argusleader.com. Also look for him on Twitter. Mike Card from the University of South Dakota, we appreciate your time as well.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here. Have a great day, all.